I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Luís Graça from Portugal. Luís, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Greg. Actually, it's an honor to be here. I have to say to everyone that I'm a big fan. You probably don't know, but you play a big role in my life back in 2020, 21, you know, when we were like, it's the Ukrainian mandatory curfews in, you know, back in COVID times. And I spent, you know, lots of hours listening to your work, to Frody. And I know that it's a really hard work to do all of this, you know, to put all these contents. It's a lot of energy, time, and so on. So as a listener, I have to say that thank you so much for all the effort for you, that you and Frody and other ones that, you know, do this work. I really, really appreciate.
We have lots of mutual friends, but the first time we met was a little more than a year ago in Madrid at an event, I think it was in January of last year. And we were talking, and yes, we have mutual friends like Frody Midjord, and it was just good to get in touch. I almost met you in 2019, but I was prevented from visiting Portugal by the government of Norway, which arrested me and prevented me from speaking at the Skanza Forum there. And then, you know, I basically spent, you know, 48 hours with no sleep. And they told me that, well, I was free to go. It was all a misunderstanding. If you want to stay, you're welcome. You can hang out. You can grieve this in the legal system, etc. Or we bought you this deportation ticket. You can just go back home. And I thought, I really wish I could go to Portugal because we were going to go to a concert there, and Frody was going to be there, and some other friends were going to be there. We're going to meet up. There was a conference happening, but I just said, I need some rest. So I just took the deportation flight, flew home, and we missed meeting. But the first time I saw you was in some video that was taken on that trip. And then I recognized you at this event last year in Madrid. And so it's a great pleasure to finally actually have you on the show. And of course, the occasion for this is we want to talk about your book. You've just published a book called Ukraine, an Identitarian Perspective. And looking into this, I discovered, oh, we had a lot more mutual friends than I thought, a lot of friends in Ukraine. And it turns out that this book is dedicated in part to the memory of Sergei Zaikovsky, who is the dedicatee of my book, Against Imperialism. And he was a friend of mine and a friend of yours. He was killed early on in the war in March of 2022, and he had been translating my White Nationalist Manifesto into Ukrainian. And so reading this book, I immediately thought we need to talk about this, because I think this is a really valuable book. And it's a book that I didn't have the patience to write myself. I wish I could have the patience to write this book, because there's so much nonsense that's been said about Ukraine and the Ukraine war. And I don't have the patience to deal with it. I just want to reach through the internet and strangle people when I hear this stuff. I was very, very impressed with how patiently and carefully you went through all of this propaganda and take it apart. And so let's get into that in a bit. But before we do that, can you tell us a little bit about your background? I'd like to know how you, a young Portuguese man, became an identitarian and also built contacts all over Europe in places like Ukraine and places like Italy and so forth. So do you want to give us a little background on yourself and your journey?
Sure, of course. Yeah, just before that, I remember it was 2019. It was like this Eric Kaufman that wrote the book White Papers, not White Shift, White Shift. And yeah, it was actually a very nice, event. It was in the very leftist university. This actually, and it was like also this Norwegian, like like teacher, like she was part of academia, and she was very left wing, and it was only like right wingers attending to these events, and yeah, she got totally destroyed, literally, because like, as you can imagine, in the end, it was like the question time, and you know, it was only people like right wingers, like Frody, like this can, guy from Canada. I think it was working for Frody or for
George. George.
You know, they really throw like really hard questions to her, and you know, like some red pill questions, and she got she got in a very very difficult situation. It was very very interesting moments. But yeah, 2019, and I have to go back maybe 10 years before that, when I started to do my my journey, you know. So I was like 16, 2009, exactly, yeah, when I became, you know, to be interested in nationalism, mostly because of my father, because he was always also in politics, and he's a very known right winger in Portugal. More recently, he was part of Chega. That's second now. He's second place on in Portugal, and it was quite influenced at some point. So I got influence from him, and I started like my journey, you can say, my activism around this time. And sometimes I'm more active, sometimes I'm less. And because in Portugal we never had like a very strong movement. I was always very enthusiastic about doing stuff. So I put myself always like to travel a lot, to meet other comrades, and to know different movements and different realities. And this is the reason I probably know a lot of people around Europe. It was because, you know, it was like a desert in terms of political activism at some point in Portugal. So I was always like going to events or concerts, you name it. And yeah, I started to be also more serious about this around 2017, when I was like, okay, I'm identitarian. I want to create my own identitarian movement. It was already one that I joined. And yeah, I have a really good memories. I made really good friends. Yeah, I always like the idea of identitarian, you know, more than nationalists or other, you know, other term or other.
What does the term identitarian mean to you, as opposed to more conventional ideas of nationalism?
Yeah, very good question. So I always, you know, we started always like, you know, more civic nationalism and so on. And when you're after, you are totally edgy. Normally it's like this, you know, and you go like these super edgy, controversial ideologies. But this wasn't enough for me, you know, like I never felt like this glamorous thing about these totalitarian regimes from the 30s and 20s and 40s. So I saw the, like, you know, 2010, 11, I started to see like Guillaume Fay, Benoit, Venere, and all these like Europeistic movements around Europe. You know, they were very pro-Europe, and I was like always very into this pre-Christian or Indo-European or civilization, you know, all our common grounds. And I was always fascinated by this. And I noticed that, you know, identitarians, especially in France, they were very rooted on these beliefs. Especially the first generation of identitarians, they were very, you know, proto-pagan. Now it's not about that, but in the beginning it was definitely like this. They even used, like, before they used the lambda or other symbols, they used to use like a wild boar, for example. This was the main reference and symbol of the identitarians in France. And only afterwards they start to have like this the GI, the Generation Identitaire, and also IB in Germany, in Austria, Identitären Bewegungen. And it was more like leaning to activism, like non-violent activism. And also this was like also very fascinated, because they brought like a very positive like narrative and image, very good optics. They were clearly trying to go out of the political ghetto that the nationalism was part of it, you know, because before, you know, before Twitter and Telegram, you know, of course, you know that our movement was very marginalized and wasn't so popular like nowadays. And yeah, this was very, very fascinating. And they did like this spectacular like activities and demonstrations. And I was like very into it. And yeah, since the beginning, I was following this this process and their activities. And, you know, with time, I was meeting people here and there. So I could say that my activism started 2009 and all the way here, yes.
So a lot of identitarian groups were very much connected with and still are connected with music fan scenes and musical subcultures. Was that part of your journey at all?
The identitarians, I wouldn't say they're that much connected with music. Like in France, of course, we had like this music scene that was very specific. Because in the beginning of the identitarian groups, it was also this nationalist autonomous. So this like black bloc optics. And they have like, you know, a very strong skinhead scene and their like skinhead music and hardcore music. And Italians were a bit aside of this and they're like more like folkish music, indie kind of ish in France. So never was like this very strong. Like maybe you are mixing with like the Italian, like Casa Pound. There, yes, the that's other world, you know, that the different scene. They don't say they are themselves identitarians. They say like they are fascists or maybe use another term nowadays. And yeah, the music there is like it was very, very strong, especially 2014 all the way to 19, you know, with iconic bands like Zeta Zero Alpha, Bronson, you name it.
So you have been to Casa Pound as well, I understand. How did that play a role in your development?
Yeah, I think I started to listen. Like Casa Pound exists since 2005, maybe. I think five.
I think it was a little earlier than that. I think it was like 2003, something that.
You're right. You're right. So someone was in contact with them. And I remember like getting this like this magazine from them. I still have it. And yeah, it was quite a thing, you know, like they occupied like a full building and they have like their pubs, their libraries. It looked like it was impossible to believe that it was such a big structure. I don't know. They always like had this in my mind, like Casa Pound, okay, I like it. But when I started this identitarian organization in Portugal called Escudo Identitário, so half of them are really like into the identitarians, like new right type of thing. And like the other half were more like the social parts, the Casa Pounds, you know, like giving food to or first aid to you know, homeless people and so on. And so, like, the group was divided by this. And yeah, I had the opportunity to go there in 2016. And yeah, I went there, I think, twice a year sometimes. And yeah, I established a very good contact. They were really nice people. They receive, like, people very well. You feel very warm there. Especially like 2006 until 2019, like it was their prime. It was insane. Like walking in Rome, especially, you could see so many Casa Pounds, you know, from stickers, posters, you know, and there, they had like so many like bars and places that you can hang out in Rome and around Rome. It was, and you could like easily walk in Rome and find people with Casa Pound t-shirts or related with Casa Pound t-shirts or their bands. It was quite fascinating. It was very good times, very optimistic times. I was so into this that I even missed the times of, you know, the memoir, for example, in America. So it was like this also revolution, digital revolution in America that I really, I didn't ignore. I didn't care about it. So I only, after a while, I have noticed that it was like this like big phenomenon happening in America, because I was so into these European movements, not only in Italy, but also in France and in Germany. Yeah.
One thing I've noticed about the movement in Italy, but also in other countries in Europe as well, is that it's possible for them to be very insular, for instance, in Italy, simply because there's so much going on. You could spend your entire life just trying to keep track of what's happening on the Italian right. And so given that there's so much going on, and it's not just drama, it's actual practical stuff, people are creating things, it's very, very easy to just sort of not pay attention to what's outside and not have contacts with people in other parts of the movement. And so I found that to be kind of remarkable. That's a good problem to have, in a way, where there's so much going on that it's almost an afterthought to pay attention to, say, the American scene and so forth.
Let me just interrupt you, because today I was talking with a friend, you know, like a group chat, and we were like reading this, it's like this drama that's keep happening in America, you know, like it was Nick Fuentes and now this Dan Blizzard, how, I don't know how to say his name, but you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, it's an Armenian name. It's Bilzerian.
Bilzerian, yes. You know, this like they're attacking each other, you know, creating chaos and drama and divide. And, you know, it's always like since, you know, like I was aware of this since in the beginning, you know, since 2016, it's like this. And I'm thinking, like, you guys have, like, so many resources, way more healthier, freedom of speech. You have everything to create, like, a real good movement with quality, with structure, you know. And you guys, you know, keep killing each other and, like, being very nihilistic, and we Europeans with our limits, you know, like no free speech, way less resources, you know, way less healthier, you know, we are like squatting houses and creating like Iliads, re-immigration summits, re-immigration institutes, you know, trying to create like a good strategy and, you know, create something. It's very interesting, like this contrast.
Part of the problem with all of America's free speech, and of course there are lots of limitations on free speech in America, but they're not from the government. They come from basically private organizations who are censoring, and even X is still censorious. I have been banned from X since Elon Musk took power and instituted his free speech regime there, for instance. But the trouble with America is, with all of our free speech, we have a movement that's almost nothing but speech, nothing but talk. And of course, if you have to talk 4 hours a day about something, well, you start talking shit about the people who are very close to you in practically every possible way. But because you're in the business of speaking for 4 hours a day, well, these people are now your rivals. They're your rivals in this economy for attention that you're in. And so I think that because there's so much free speech in America, we have a movement that's almost entirely speech. And well, when you're just sort of speaking idly, right? Isn't the saying that idle hands are the, you know, the devil's plaything or the devil's tools? Well, idle tongues wagging end up doing the devil's work, right? And so I think that because a lot of European groups are constrained by censorship, they speak less, but they do more. And they do more practical things. And I like that about the European scene. One of the things that I noticed when I met some people from Casa Pound last year was that they don't sit around complaining about how bad things are all the time, which is basically what the entire online movement is in America, is just complaining about bad stuff. Why aren't they sitting around complaining? Well, because they're meeting face to face with friends and they can actually do positive things and live their lives. And I just think that's a tremendously more healthy ethos. It's a tremendously more healthy situation. And yes, of course, it would be nice if you had more freedom of speech. But in some ways, I think the constrictions on freedom of speech in Europe have forced people to be more civil and more practical and to create more healthy communities and to actually get more done in the political realm.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you, definitely. I also had this comparison, especially, for example, I really like the optics from the French, the Austrian, and the German, especially the identitarians. You know, they're very, very good image. And of course, they have to refine them because they have so much pressure from the state. And, you know, if they say something too edgy, they can have like serious problems to their lives. And because of this, they really put a big effort, how they look, what they say, the semantic, all of this stuff. In contrast, you know, for example, Portugal or even worse, Spain, that is, you know, is the law doesn't work so well or doesn't apply so well. And you can say more or less almost everything. It's not like a big consequences. You know, you can still do your life. It's not like America, but sometimes pretty close. It's quite crazy. And because of that, you know, it's why you still have like this really cringe, you know, skinhead, you know, movements or scenes or even the rhetoric that I really don't appreciate. So yeah, maybe if we had like pressure from the state, like in these countries, we will, like, I will say we, but whatever, we will just, you know, refine our, you know, our narratives, how we expose our ideas, the optics and so on. So yeah, I totally agree with you. Yeah, I and they're very practical in Italy. Yeah. And although they're Italians, you know, sometimes they arrive late, you know, sometimes they, you know, they take some time to do stuff and so on. But yeah, they definitely show a very good example. And despite, you know, they had like lots of ups and downs, Casa Pound, and they still like don't give up. Yeah, they still do their own thing. I may not agree with everything or even ideological point of view, but I definitely they have my respect, and is why I keep going there and support them, you know.
So how did you get interested in Ukraine? Because it's been a long journey from you first discovering Ukraine and visiting there to actually writing this book. So let's begin the story that led to this book. How did you first visit Ukraine? How did you get involved with the nationalists there and so forth?
Starting 2013 and 14. I was very fascinated by these events, the Euromaidan, and all this revolution that was happening there. I never seen something like that. I was even in shock, you know, like it was very, you know, like see like the whole country of, okay, it wasn't the whole country, but you know, like a big chunk of the country coming together, helping each other. It wasn't only like a black block demonstration that they destroy the banks, they destroy everything, they burn cars. You know these very, very violent, you know, demonstrations you see in France or in Greece back in 2011. N12 or, you know, Black Lives Matter in America, you know, it's always very destructive, you know, it's like, and you can see it's just a fringe of the society doing this, but not in Ukraine. And I was, you know, I could see from the pictures, from the image, from the videos that, you know, it was the identity. The idea of being Ukrainian, of Ukraine, that was motivating these people. And I was in these Facebook groups that were like Ukrainians giving first-hand information of the situation over there. And I started to follow very close, not only Euromaidan, but the following events, Mariupol, the Donetsk airport siege, the famous cyborgs that they fought until they died. Yeah, so I was like very, very, like, actually, I was into Putin, you know, at some point. And, you know, when I was very, very young, I thought, oh, they are like kicking out the Pussy Riot. And, you know, they have like, Putin have like a more authoritarian persona. And I quite like, you know, I was like, okay. And I was keep reading these phrases online, like, oh, the future comes from the East, or Russia will save us, you know, because my idea was a white country and so on. And I didn't know nothing about it. And then I started to understand it's not a reality. And I kept in contact with these people from Ukraine, and I had the opportunity to go there in 2018. And I have to say, despite I was falling very close, I had no idea how Kiev, you know, looked like, and I didn't know nothing about Ukraine. You know, I only was looking at the news. I didn't know like much about the history and so on. And yeah, I went there fully with no idea, with nothing in my imaginary. And yeah, I was a very good surprise. The city was very, very, very clean. You could still see like marks from the revolution of Euromaidan. And I was mind-blowing by the nationalism there. So if people were into nationalism or patriotism, Ukraine was the place, definitely. It was totally, yeah, I was like randomly walking on the streets and see, because I could identify, like I could see what t-shirts or brands belong mm-hmm. to nationalists and so on. It's a problem with, you know, liberals in Ukraine. So I understood that many liberals, they go to Ukraine, they say, Ukraine, they don't have this problem with these subcultures and so on, you know, they have this scope. And because they don't understand, like, they don't know what brands, whatever. And I was, like, keep walking on the street, and I was, this guy, you know, like, very extreme t-shirt. Like, it was, like, oh, very radical. And, of course, then the tattoos and so on. I'm not so into this, you know, very extreme radical ideology, but it was very interesting to see how normalized it was. If this was normalized, like, normal patriotism, normal idea of nation, it was very, very normalized, and it was part of their lives. That was the thing that I was more interested in.
I followed the Euromaidan too. I remember in 2013 when it started, I had friends who were actually there. I was on Facebook at the time. I was in Facebook groups. I started getting pictures and reports. My friend John Morgan was there. That's when I first learned about Elena Semenyaka. And so I followed this. And I also followed the propaganda about it coming from other parts of our movement. And I noticed immediately that there was a huge disconnect between what I was hearing directly from Kiev and what I was hearing from Russia Today or sources that were inflected by that. And I started noticing the patterns at that point. And it was something I took note of. I followed this closely. I was hesitant at first to be too critical of other viewpoints on this, because I thought, well, maybe there's a permissible range of opinions here. It's not the most important thing. And so, but I kept watching. I kept watching and observing and seeing that there was definitely a concerted Russian propaganda operation directed at the far right in Europe and America. And the propaganda was, well, it was intense. There was certainly a lot of effort behind it. There were many voices pushing it. A lot of it was incredibly crude and stupid and dishonest, frustratingly so, insultingly so. But there was just this frenzy of it that would not go away. So I became increasingly critical of the Russian standpoint after a while, increasingly critical of figures like Dugin, increasingly supporting things like the Intermarium idea. We published a very important article on Intermarium at Countercurrents, I think in 2014 or 2015, that sparked a lot of interest in Central and Eastern Europe. And I finally actually went to Ukraine for the first time in 2018 as well. And I had the same experience that you did. I was just amazed at how open it was, how unapologetic it was, how well organized the movement was there. I went to the Reconquista Club. I got the address, right? They told me, go to this place and we're going to do this thing and you'll speak. And I said, okay. So I got in a cab and I just gave the address to the driver. And the driver said, oh, Reconquista. And I thought, this is interesting. He actually recognized the address and knew the name of the place. And I was amazed at the facilities they had. I was amazed when I went to the Cossack House, what a great setup it was, what great aesthetics, how extremely serious they were about metapolitics, about the arts, about culture, philosophy. It was thoroughly impressive. And again, it was very much like what you see in Rome with Casa Pound. They've got all these institutions that they've created. That really impressed me. I went to this big nationalist march and I observed it for a while and I walked along it. Then I sort of ended up marching in it until there was it came to an end and there was a big sort of political rally and it was all in Ukrainian. At that point, I had to go and get dinner and stuff like that. But it was a tremendously impressive experience. And I was bumping into people. The Golden One was in town, for instance. That was a tremendous experience. It was a great experience. I had friends who went off there in 2019 to Asgard's Rye, and I was just exhausted because, well, I had to deal with this business with Norway the month before, mm-hmm. for one thing, and I thought I'd like to go back. I'll go next year. But of course, next year was COVID. There was COVID in 2020 and 2021. And I was thinking, well, maybe I'll go back in 2022. And then this accursed war happened that's been going on for more than 4 years. So you've gone back since the war. How many times have you been back since the war began? And can you tell me about some of your experiences then?
Yeah, Ukraine was like quite like people have no idea like how it's like living in a nationalist regime. And that's Ukraine. Liberal girls are nationalists. Of course, then normal people are nationalists. Conservative, you know, we have a huge right-wing radical scene there. People have really, really no idea. Like, actually, you can have a picture of it. Like, if you go to the pro-Russians, I have some accounts. I think this Marta, you know, this Jewish Ukrainian from Lviv, she spends all day on Twitter showing how Nazi is Ukraine. And yeah, if you look at her X accounts, and you have a notion that how big nationalism is there. And I really hard to understand how right-wingers or conservative condemn the Ukraine cause, but whatever. Yeah, so I went 2018 first time. I really like it so much that I returned the same year, back in 2018, the winter. And I think, yeah, 18. And then I went there 2021 to escape, the COVID lockdown. So I, of course, it was like Ukraine and people didn't care about it. So I went there to get some freedom. It was this amazing, amazing summer. I was there during the summer. I think it was August even. And it was so nice. Definitely the city was about to start to be trendy because you had this very popular show on HBO, Chernobyl. I started to see Americans there. I saw like joy. I saw like positive and like future for the city. Of course, we're talking about Ukraine, is a poor country. They have very good service. You know, very developed, even sometimes more than like top 10 countries, but in terms of health, but you know, it's still like a poor country. And I could see like definitely like Kyiv to be like a new Prague or something. Of course, this also will bring like other problems. Of course, the city will become more liberal, but that's a different issue. But I could like the vibe was really nice. It was really nice back in 2021. Of course, they had like a war, trench war in Donbass, a static war, but the reality there was very, very different. And I even could see like the patriotic sense like fading away. People were forgetting about it. People were enjoying too much about their lives at this point. And then, yeah, the war started. I think I had a ticket to go there. 2022, and I declined, and I want to return, but I didn't want to do like dark tourism, just go there and see the misery and the war, you know, just to have a like cool experience. Although I had friends and connections there, but I didn't want to do that. But also I felt a bit empty for only doing donations. So a friend of mine, she told me, you can do like work in NGO, you can do humanitarian work. So yeah, I dropped my work and I went there to rebuild houses, demolishing houses, and other stuff related with helping Ukrainians. So I went to Lviv and to Kyiv. And yeah, the first time I did listen to a siren, it was quite interesting moment because I was in the fifth floor of a building and it was next to a kindergarten. So I was like, listen to the kids, very young kids, you know, like they're very naive voice and screaming and playing. And same time I was listening to the siren, you know, that's, you know, I think about death and destruction. So at this contrast, it was very, very interesting. This was 2023, by the way. And I saw people were very positive. So this was like during the counter-offensive of the Ukrainians in the summer. Then later they failed. But it was still very positive. Could see like even the fashion brand, like the fashion trends. It was like this urban military. So people, like normal civilians, were dressing like military, but with the fashion side of it. So the society was very much on the war and trying to win it. It was very different 2004 and 2025. Definitely, people are way less motivated. The moral is not there anymore as before. People are tired of it. Yeah, because of course it's 4 hours now. It spends more than 4 years. people are so tired of it, and also corruption inside of Russia, Ukrainian governments and Ukrainian armed forces, that I think this is the main factor, actually. It's not because... Yeah, I think it's the main factor of it, is that demoralized people. Yeah, I was in close situations that was very dangerous. In Lviv, that I thought, okay, I'm going to stay, like, because I was a bit, like, I was looking at the news, okay, Kiev has been, like, with, like, really rough night, so I'm going to stay a few more nights in Lviv. In Lviv, the most western part of Ukraine. And yeah, I was very wrong. Like, that night, I was like this hypersonic ballistic missile, like, that exploded like 1 kilometer next to me. It was actually a very, very sad day in Lviv. It was this Kinzhal missile, and they killed like the mother and like two or three daughters, and the husband survived, and it was very tense in that day. But at the same time, you know, this is like shows the resilience.
Yeah.
Yes, of Ukrainian people. You know, everyone was like helping.
One of the theses in your book that I thought was really quite powerful is in the first chapter, where you talk about the topic, you know, Ukraine exists. Obviously, Ukraine exists. We shouldn't have to devote any time to this thesis, but we live in a world where there are people who literally deny that Ukraine is a real country. And of those would be Russians and Russian sympathizers in the West. Just as the Jews in Israel deny that there's any such thing as a Palestinian, Russians deny that there's any such thing as Ukrainians. Ukrainians are just Russians with false consciousness, basically, and they just need to have that beaten out of them eventually. That's the Russian attitude. And there were two things that you said about this that I thought were really quite interesting. One is that this attitude that Ukraine isn't real is one of the reasons why Russia failed so badly, because they simply didn't have the ability to conceive of the Ukrainians as a distinct people with their own identity that would fight back. And the other thing that I thought was really fascinating, and maybe you can expand on this too, is that before the war, it might have been the case that if you asked a Ukrainian, so what's the difference between you and Russians? A lot of them would be hard-pressed to say anything. Well, we speak a slightly different language, whatever, but we eat the same kind of food and, you know, wear the same kind of clothes and have the same basic religion, and our literature and music, it all overlaps. And they would have some difficulty. Some of them might have had difficulty really articulating a strong sense of national identity. But you argue, and you've seen this, that since the war began, since the Russian invasion, there's a far stronger sense of Ukrainian national identity. Do you want to talk a bit about that? And maybe you can illustrate that with some of the things that you've seen?
Yes, definitely. 100%. I think, definitely. You know, I've been reading books, pro-Russian books, and they always have this chapter denying Ukrainian, you know, that it's not a real country, that's like a fake artificial, you know, and that only exists since 2091. But guess what? Also, Russia, you know, the Federation of Russia only exists since 2091. You know, if you go back, you know, you had like the Sovietics, and you have the Ukrainian state, you have the Russian state, and before you had like the Russian Empire, which is not, you know, so you can debate, it's very, very easy to debunk their pseudo arguments. Yeah, and I think many Russians they really, really think that this was a reality, and they were so they still believe so much that that Ukraine is only extension of their country that you can portray very well, especially on Kharkiv of like back in 2022. When many Russians they just went to the city, being Kharkiv, the second biggest city in Ukraine, they really thought that this was part of the Ruski Mir, and we have these episodes. This is true; it's not fake. We have this Spetsnaz that special operation guys that they went all the way to the city center, to the heart of the city. They really thought, they forgot totally about the tactics, about their military doctrine. They ignore it, and they went there just purely because, they believed it was ideological. It was part of their core. They could just enter with a red carpet. And enter inside of the country. I didn't put this in my book, but I knew this story. So they just went inside Kharkiv. Everything was playing according the books, about according to their ideology, about their beliefs. Yeah, but they were entering inside of the city because they were entering inside like a trap. Actually, they had the same situation in Grozny, in the first invasion of Grozny. So they went inside, they got trapped, they started to fly bullets against them. They went inside of a school. The school is still closed, and actually the bodies are still inside nowadays. And yeah, they fought until they died in a very brave way. But this illustrates very well how naive they are and how they are blinded about this. And you really think that Ukraine is part of their world, and that's not the reality. Even in Kharkiv, it's supposedly to be very pro-Russian. It was so many volunteers and they joined and they fought for the city. Actually, the guy that's the cover on my book, this is like if you can see the cover, the guy is a guy from Kharkiv, and he's a volunteer, and this is the first days of war. Actually, yeah, I know him; he's my friend, and it really shows and really debunks how fake this narrative is. And going back to the Ukrainians, yeah, I many Ukrainians were disconnected with this. They really thought it was, something far away in Donetsk, that the fight was happening and the Russians will never attack them, because many thought they were like brothers. They didn't felt Ukrainians, but they felt, okay, we are brothers. Maybe like Austrians and Germans, I don't know. And since the full-scale invasion, of course, they got this sense of being Ukrainian, and even many stopped speaking Russian and only speak Ukrainian or speak more Ukrainian. This is also very complex, this language issue in Ukraine. But yeah, definitely, Ukrainians nowadays they f even feel more Ukrainians. And it shows how bad was this idea of invading Ukraine, because they really create this very strong identity, because of course they already have, and they've proven many times, with the referendum it was in the 90s, where the population shown that they want to become part of Ukraine. In many other occasions, they've shown that Ukraine exists. But yeah, with this full-scale invasion, it really proves like you cannot even deny. I think even Dugin wrote something about it. I'm pretty sure you're like. I remember very, very well, like after the first year of the war, or after the first 6 months of the war, Dugin was very critical against Putin and about how bad was the situation in Russia. Now he switched, you know, he's a bit, since his daughter actually got killed, we still don't know if it was actually even Russians, but that's another case. Definitely, he did some criticism saying like, oh, the situation was so bad for Russia that now even create like a really strong identity among Ukrainians.
Yeah, it's so ironic. Russia wanted to basically erase the Ukrainian identity, and it strengthened it by attacking. Russia wanted to, at least ostensibly, one of the excuses that they used was keeping NATO away. Russia wanted to keep NATO away, and now NATO is much stronger. NATO has grown. Countries like Finland and Sweden have brought their very serious and powerful militaries into NATO. And NATO as a whole has a greater sense of mission than it did before. So by attacking Ukraine, Putin strengthened the Ukrainian identity and strengthened NATO and expanded NATO and hardened Europe against him. Whereas before this, if he had just left well enough alone, I think that NATO would probably have slowly faded away. And probably the Ukrainian identity would have slowly faded as well, especially as Ukraine got more prosperous. And yet he's completely achieved the opposite of what he wanted to. Another huge irony of this is that it really showed us that Russia is not the powerful country that we thought it was. I believed that Russia was going to just steamroll Ukraine when the war started. I was thinking, oh my gosh, I hope my friends just flee the country, right? And they didn't flee. They stood up and they displayed great valor. They pushed the Russians back a great deal. I think Russia had taken about a third of the country and they pushed them back to about 20%. I came to realize that Russia's great military buildup and Russia's strength under Putin might have just been illusory. It might have just been propaganda. They were good at making memes, but they weren't actually good at building up a strong society because the military has behaved very poorly. And they sacrificed an impression of being the second most powerful military in the world. And they basically took that bluff and they let the Ukrainians call their bluff. And I think that Russia's international standing has declined dramatically. It's just not taken as seriously as it used to be, which is, again, a huge loss for Russia.
Yes. But with some caveats, Greg. I agree with you. They failed this operation. It was very harmful for their armed forces. But also shown how weak Europeans are. I don't know if we are in a better position now than before. Because also Russians thought that maybe Europeans also had like some strength or some like military that was capable to stop Russia. But now you can see like definitely that we have really, really structural problems in Europe. So it shows both ways, how weak we can be and how hard sometimes we can unite to help Ukraine. But Russia also, for example, Prigozhin or a Greek, the ex-leader of Wagner or a Greek that's in jail that was part of the coup in Donetsk. they are very critic to from the for the Russian invasion and for the Russian army, but also they show how resilient they can be. They keep like being, you know, Russians send, you know, their soldiers to this meat grinder, and they keep losing their equipment and their tanks and their Black Sea flee, and still they're fighting, you know. And I don't, especially nowadays, I don't think they will, you know, stop or quit or pause. So we also shown like how Russians, you know, because, you know, we have to see this and be realistic about it, you know. Russia, because I think in the first 2 years or 2 years and a half, there was lots of voices against Putin, but of course Putin disarrayed these voices, and maybe now this in the cycle now is very unanimous about this invasion, and they are cooperating and focus about this, and not, you know, having conspiracy against Putin or about their own institutions. So yeah, I think it's a question of life and death for them. So they are definitely very focused, and you know, we cannot laugh about Russia because they're still dangerous. They can shown like they can still like, you know, produce weapons. Like I remember like first year, you know, saying, oh, Russian army will collapse, it's the end for them. But I was always like a bit like, let's see about it, you know. I was like, they were still like sending flying jets to Azerbaijan, so I thought, how is possible? They are selling equipment, but then they have lack of equipment in the front line. So something wasn't also making sense. Also, we have to be sometimes a bit frontal about it. But yeah, definitely Russia, it was, I also thought that Russia will, you know, at least go to Lviv and maybe stop there. Took half of the country very easily in the first months of the war, and it wasn't the case. And we know the story now. You know, they got corrupt very well. The secret services, they got tricked, and they show how amateur they were and how they cannot mobilize the whole country for this, you know, because this takes a lot of resources, understanding of the reality, and organization, and they had a big lack of it, because they have lots of corruption between the lower scale of the commands. And I don't know, it's only speculation. Putin thoughts, okay, we have the favorite conditions, and this is the best time. We know Joe Biden's it's Joe Biden. He cannot speak properly. He cannot make decisions. Europe is woke. Is weak. So it's the best timing for them. And actually, Olena told you know, our common friend. I also was a bit. Believed that about the invasion, and she said like, yeah, one day they will invade when Europe will be very, very weak. They definitely will take advantage, and sadly she was right, and only 8 months after they invaded. But I won't say like in a good way, they, because you know, still Ukrainians are keep dying, and many died, and families got destroyed, and one of the most important chapters of my or subchapters of my book is that the fact that many Ukrainians, it's not the fact that many are dying, of course it's very bad, and many died and are dying, but my real issue with Putin with this war is that the quantity of Ukrainians, young Ukrainians, that were forced or voluntarily went out of Ukraine. And now, you know, instead of living, you know, all their lives, you know, they maybe could just be immigrant in the future, but probably when they want to work and better conditions and so on. But at least they will stay in Ukraine until they were 18, 19, 20. And they have like all their lives, you know, with their Ukrainian education and culture and living in a homogeneous country and not living in a liberal atmosphere. And now they were forced to live in Germany, France, Portugal, Italy, Norway, Ireland, where it's like this very, very, very liberal, progressive, woke, left-wing schools, environments, and so on. And imagine you're very young and you think about Putin and you hate it. You're forced to leave your country. And what is associated with Putin being conservative, traditional, authoritarian, and so on. So these young kids, they want to be the opposite of it. You know, they want to fight this. And, you know, being in these environments on the Western countries, they will most probably they will become very, very liberal. And this is the thing that I focus in my book and one of the Shub chapters. It's actually something that I developed. And I think this is the saddest part of the story, you know.
It's very sad. There's a terrible demographic toll that is being wreaked on Ukraine because of the deaths of people, the deaths of whole families, and of course, all the people who've been forced to flee the country or fled the country, whether they were forced to or not. And they may never come back. Or if they do come back, they may be altered in many ways that are not good. So yeah, I think that's terrible. And it's, you know, I put this all on Putin, of course. This is definitely his doing, and it's just another thing that we blame him for. But it is going to be very difficult for Ukraine to deal with its demographic problems. And of course, Russia has similar demographic problems. And once this war is done, I hope Ukraine doesn't make some stupid mistakes. I hope they find ways of luring back their refugees, luring back their diaspora, and that they are not going to open their borders to guest workers and third worlders and people like that. I mean, rebuilding Germany after the Second World War is the reason why they ended up with all these Turks who are living there now for generations. So that's a great danger that they face. One thing that I thought was a very reasonable part of your book is your brief discussion of Zelensky. I just thought it was note perfect. I agreed with everything that you said. Do you want to talk a bit about your thoughts on Zelensky?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't like Zelensky, but I can talk about him, no problem. Actually, many of the takes I took from Martin's perspective, someone that I'm also in contact. I think maybe also like you know him, and we share like the same view. We are not like this, especially now. This topic is very known, and from the left to the right, it's like anti-Semitic or like this Jewish conspiracy and so on. You can say it's valid or not. It's not what you're talking about. And this becomes so popular that knowing that Zelensky is a Jew, automatically they will be on the side of Russia or they will be neutral. Of course, sometimes they are naive and they don't know being neutral actually helps Russia and is kind of being pro-Russia. So this is a big challenge because sometimes I talk with some people and some like really hardcore anti, you know, Zionism and so on. They are so blind about the situation that they put aside of and okay, he's a Jew. It was put there because of Jews and But again, like for me, this Zionist Jewish question is very complex, and especially in Europe, it's not so obvious or not so straightforward like UK or your country, America, United States of America. And also the same happens in Ukraine. Obviously, Jews take advantage of the situation. In Ukraine, they act like like gangsters there, and they take advantage of the chaos, of the misery, to do their own things over there. But 100%, this wasn't a Jewish conspiracy. Like Zelensky never was a Jewish advocate. Like he never was like very religious. It was always very neutral about this. Wasn't never like into this Kabbalah thing. Recently it was showing some drama against Israel, boycotting Israel, something that for example Orban never did, and Zelensky did. He was married with a Christian he's married with a Christian woman. He never like said something about Christianity or was doing something malicious against it. Obviously, I was against Zelensky before full-scale invasion. He was trying to be too neutral, and the nationalists didn't like it, and he was oppressing them. But yeah, when the war started, he acted like a real leader should be. And it's so cynical because many of these right wingers, these conservative people, they really like the idea of the old times, when there was the kings and the big generals and Napoleon, like they really like strong people. And Zelensky, with all their his defaults, because he have a lot of defaults, his corruption, his and so on. But he stood in Ukraine. It was so easy to leave Ukraine. People have no idea. He chose to be there. But some people are, oh, it was a puppet. A puppet of what? What would he like benefit with that? He have his life for the rest of his life, his family, his wife, his children, his own life in threat until he will die, So what's the benefit? Like it's so surreal. And he stood, he was the voice, actually he was the voice of the Ukrainian people. He probably have no other option because he saw like such a big mobilization of the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian army. Maybe not even him was expecting. And he seemed like the world in his side as well. And he stayed, and he keeps going to the front lines. And something, of course, some things, very peculiar things in Ukraine. He's very bad to communicator. He deals very bad with journalists. Sometimes very rude. Makes no sense. But yeah, that's it. When the time show, like it was a real. A real leader, and many times, when he was in the White House, many people were doing critics to him, but this was so obvious. Like it was actually a guy that wasn't like afraid. It wasn't on his knees, and he stood for his country. It was very, very, very insane. He doesn't give up
Absolutely.
of this.
Yeah. My reaction to him when he first got elected was an eye roll. It's like, oh God, the last thing Ukraine needs is this Jewish comedian who's done like tasteless TV humor as their president. This isn't going to end up well. When the war came, unlike Yanukovych, that we are all supposed to piously regard as the democratically elected leader who was run out of the country by the Maidan coup, right? Unlike Yanukovych, who fled when the people rose up against him. Zelensky stood his ground. Zelensky could have fled the country. He could have fled the country and been a hero. He could have been feted, and people would have said, "Oh, he's like any number of rulers in exile. He could have been like General de Gaulle, right, in the Second World War." But no, he stood his ground. He stayed there, and he's been impressive for just that reason. I have to give him a lot of credit just for standing his ground and putting his life on the line. He could have just disappeared into the bushes, could have scuttled off like a cockroach, could have taken a bunch of money and fled the country, and he didn't. And I have to respect that. And I think any normally constituted person has to respect that. Now, as soon as the war is over, I hope they get a different guy in. It would be nice if there's a little circulation, maybe a Ukrainian running the country, or a non-Jewish Ukrainian. But it would be this would be good. But the truth is that what am I supposed to do when there are people who say, "Well, you know, I'd sympathize with the Ukrainians. Why don't they get back to me when they have a new president, right? Get back to me when you've got a new president. I don't like this president. You people shouldn't be fighting for your country because you've got the wrong president." Or a country loses its sovereignty if they have a Jewish president for some reason. All of these are completely arbitrary and idiotic premises that a lot the anti-Zelensky people just love to ride on. And I find that contemptible and laughable. The Ukrainians are going to fight for their homeland no matter who the president is. They're not going to turn on their president in a time of war when they're actually being invaded by Russians. Give me a break. And Zelensky has probably been, on balance, good for the country. The fact that he is Jewish, I think, is one of the reasons why the libtards across the West are so fervently pro-Ukrainian. And that's good for the Ukrainians, frankly, that Ukraine has such a good press for all the wrong reasons. And you talk about some of your experiences when you were in Ukraine working with these NGOs helping out after the war started. And the liberals who are just in a complete denial or delusion about what kind of country Ukraine is. Do you want to talk a bit about that? I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yes, because lots of people say, "Oh, yeah, Zelensky created the situation for the war. It was very antagonistic, you know, the NATO expansion and so on and so on. And he was Jewish, you know, this is the perfect, you know, persona to this narrative." But they always forget that Zelensky won the elections for a super pro-Ukrainian, you know, Poroshenko. You know, imagine if Zelensky loses the election and Poroshenko wins, you know. It was the guy that started the Ukrainization in Ukraine, was Poroshenko. So probably Poroshenko will be even more, you know, aggressive towards, or not so natural against Russia. So all these arguments, they really have no validation because of this. And it really shows how they don't know nothing about this country or this region of the European country. Of the European continent. This is actually how it's easy for Russia to do their propaganda, because people have no idea about the history, the languages of these, you know, Belarus, even Poland, Ukraine, Russia. So it's, for many Westerners, this is like a mythology even, you know, they have some ideas, you know, they have like these ideas of this, you know, Chernobyl, as you know, Sovietic, whatever, and it's very easy for Russia to create this propaganda. And even I did talk about this in my book presentation, because you have like the official Russian propaganda, so it's to fight the Nazis, NATO expansion, you know, all of this. But the Russian propaganda is very complex and it's very organic. And they have like its own life. So we have this official Kremlin propaganda, and then we have like the X or Twitter, Telegram, Instagram, social media propagandists, you know, saying like, oh, Russia is fighting the global homo, you know, fighting the Zionism and so on and so on. And it's very interesting because they go out of the Russian propaganda and they create their own coping system, you know, which is very, very interesting. It's definitely was a big challenge for me to write the book. And now about your, going back to your question. Yes, it was very interesting because you met lots of interesting people on these NGOs, especially 2 years ago, wasn't so many people, like foreigners. So you could easily find people from Red Cross, from ONU, from European Union, from the American Embassy, you know, the director of the Kiev Independent, you know, so it was a very small community, so you could find very, very interesting people that you probably wouldn't have like possibility in a normal life. And, you know, I remember so well, like one time we were demolishing a house north of Kiev, it was like this incredible fauna of people. So it was like this gay Italian liberal guy, quite young, like late 20s, was like this. It was 60, like it was 59 years old, British guy with a kilt. It was saying it was an anarchic. He was living in his community, you know, we were doing orgies and stuff like that. It was crazy. And there was like a woman from the American embassy, and there was like me, and there was like these young, very young Ukrainian girls, you know, very insane. And like this, like English guy, this like left wing guy, it was very ideological, and it was like, okay, I'm helping Ukraine because I'm anti-imperialism. But I know a little bit of Russian. I study a little bit of Russian, you know. And sometimes I go and I see signs saying Russian language is not allowed. And he was confronting this to the woman that was on the American embassy, American woman from the American embassy, and to the like progressive Italian guy. And they were like rolling their eyes, and they started to be super upset with this question because it was saying like, oh, so I'm against, it was saying, okay, I'm against imperialism, but also I'm against, you know, these are also very xenophobic and so on. Do you guys agree with this value that you agree with this? And they were like colliding their worldview, you know, because they were like free speech, freedom, equality, and they were like leaving this country where, you know, discriminating a language or ethnic group is totally valid and allowed. And this was so interesting. They were denying it, but they also were accepting. And yeah, the Italian guy started to be really upset and very emotional about it. So this is one of the episodes. Like they have no idea like where they went or where they are. They really believe on the liberal narrative, or they don't know nothing about it. They only think Putin fascists and so on. And when they go there, they don't even notice, you know, they are so blind with their ideology because, you know, you could see also this phenomenon in Europe. Many, many leftists, they don't want to see the real problems that Europe have. So, of course, when they were in Ukraine, probably also they didn't see some contradiction of their worldviews. And also they, when sometimes I confront them also because I did it, I didn't want to accept because, you know, imagine you go to other country, you know, living with your savings, put your life in risk, helping a cause, and then like a guy saying like, oh, you know, it's a lot of, you know, people here are very conservative and probably they don't accept your views, and look at that guy with, you know, skinhead t-shirt or whatever, you know, but they don't accept this, you know. And yeah, it was quite unique, you know, quite unique. When I'm saying this, I'm not saying that, of course, Ukraine is very, have like their own subgroups, you know, we have left-wing people, liberal people, progressive, conservative. It's not like how also Russia says it is. Of course, it's very overreacted and it's not true, but definitely Ukraine is way more traditional and more conservative and not so woke as other countries. And yeah,
what is the message of this book? What are you trying to get across in Ukraine and Identitarian Perspective?
I put it in the beginning of my book, in the introduction, like I defend Ukraine, of course, putting my connections aside and so on, and my emotional sides. I'm a true Europeist. Like I really believe in Europe. I'm Portuguese, but also I'm European. And Ukraine is European, and is in my interest that Ukraine keeps European or to be in a sphere of influence of Europe, not European Union. Can be also European Union. I have no issue with that. But, you know, in a civilization point of view, I want to, you know, makes no sense to lose Ukraine for some Euro-Asian project that I don't view myself in it. You know, I clearly see that Russia have its own thing going on, so they don't think themselves as Europeans. They have some influence of Europe, they understand this, but they really put themselves aside. And it's in my interest to have Ukraine in my side, you know, because they are part of our civilization or of our biological core. They have a big, I won't say massive is like Mali or Canada, but a big portion of lands that should be part of our interest. They have like huge gas resource, oil, rare earths, and very fertile soil, something that Europe doesn't have. So especially nowadays, that we are so weak in terms of energy, natural resources, having Ukraine part of our side makes more sense than ever. So this is the main message of my book. So I put aside international law, arbitrary human rights. So it's not about that. It's definitely a very ethnocentric, Europeic-centric book. I talk about our goals and interests more than anything else. I show that Ukraine have its own roots, its own identity, its identity is rooted in European spirit and civilization, and therefore should be part of our sphere.
That's very nicely said. I really appreciate that. So the book has come out in English and Portuguese. Do you have plans to bring it out in other languages?
Yeah, well, actually, you said something very interesting. You said like, this is the book I should written before. I came across with other people as I read the book and said the same thing. So it will be in Italian. It will be at Passaggio al Bosco. Also very interesting organization, so like Casa Pounds, but is more focused in the Firenze area. If you don't know about it, you should look at it. Also, they have like their very, very interesting cultural headquarters, and they have a publishing house called Passaggio al Bosco, also in French. Some people really want to publish this in French. We still have to see like which one like wants to publish. And I have another like other idea, also a German one called Metapol. I'm in contact with them, so probably also be in German. So for now, these three languages definitely will be published. Of course, it will be good if it's another language to spread the idea or the message. You know, this is my main goal. So at least these three languages, definitely, they will be published.
So let's talk a bit about Portugal and Portuguese nationalism and Portuguese identitarianism. I know a lot of people in my American audience probably really don't have much of a sense of what's going on in your country. Is there a nationalist movement? Is there a populist nationalist movement? Is there a pushback against globalization and open borders going on? Can you just give us an overview of the forces at work there on our side? And also, do you have a sense that things are getting better politically in your country?
Yes. So the Portuguese scene, or the nationalistic scene in Portugal, never was very big, successful, or expressive, like in Spain, for example, or Italy, or France, or Germany. So it was always very shy. Not many people. Not very dynamic. So I grew up always with, you know, the scene was so small, it was so unexpressive. You know, people knew each other very well. You know, we were so small that, you know, like very radical guys or traditionalistic people or monarchic, you know, they come together, you know, because wasn't enough people to form like different heterogeneous groups or subgroups. And even the conservative, they were always not active. Their voice were never active. They were, because also maybe this is a reaction, because the Portuguese political culture never was very so left-wing, so extreme, that pushed people to do something, you know. It was always very, of course, we were mostly under like a socialist party on our rule, but the changes were like very gradual, and it was so gradual that things were normalizing. It wasn't a reaction. And I think because of that, the movement never was, or for other reasons, never was so organized, or never was like the right people to lead in. It was always very marginalized. But it started to change in 2019. Also because of international phenomenon, where, you know, with the Trump or the rising right-wing populist parties in Europe, and this pushback against wokeism, you start to have like more voices, more journalists, more articles talking about it. And 2019 was like this new party called Chega. It's translated enough in English. It's basically was a dissident of center-right party, one of the biggest ones that has decided to create this populist right-wing party. And now they are second place. They are like the second biggest one, and the second biggest one with a representation on the Portuguese parliaments. And they grew up so much. And since then, the conservative movement in Portugal quite grew up, you know, not only in the party, but outside of the party. Even inside other parties, you have now like factions that are more conservative and so on. So it's very interesting. And sometimes this party, Chega, is very, very edgy. You know, they talk about re-immigration. Definitely is not like other conservative parties or populist parties that they are a bit shy talking about immigration and so on. Sometimes they are quite radical. Besides that, in the party spectrum, in the movement itself, of course, with this boom of people on social media, on X, of course, the right wing of the nationalist movement took advantage of it in an organic way and created movements. They got quite successful. I could do a lot of critics to these movements because of a lot of optics and how they organize and so on, or the message. Yeah, but they prove that they can be very, they can bring people, they can be viral on social media and influence the opinion of people. Also, with this came Afonso Gonçalves with his group called Reconquista, which is more like, they didn't call themselves identitarian. Sometimes they call, sometimes they don't. I think they are part of this spectrum, or at least, you know, internationally, they reveal themselves as, you know, part of this group. Afonso have been very successful. He's one of the most influential guys on the right in Portugal at the moment, like top three, top five. Doesn't matter, but you have like millions of views on social media. And really, for example, I was living abroad at some point, like 4 years. And I remember 2024, living in France. And many times I saw like Portuguese immigrants living in France, like watching Afonso videos, you know. You know, of course, they will put like the phone with sound, because, you know, French people don't know Portuguese, so wasn't the issue listen to a guy talking about like immigration or re-immigration or whatever. So yeah, definitely very successful pushing the message and bringing like this conversation to the social and political sphere. But of course, always we like challenges and see how much they can grow or not. But definitely, I seen a big growth since the last, especially last 5 years. I still don't believe it. You know, like I sound very positive, but I think this is the reality. Of course, the youth still very, very left, very progressive. But I see a good, healthy counterbalance. I see like normal people just trying to be normal, which is a good thing, you know.
Wonderful.
Or people, you know, taking more ideological and say, okay, I'm conservative or I'm nationalist. And nowadays, it's impossible to... I lost track, you know. I remember so well. It's a good comparison. Like I could knew everyone before, more or less. Nowadays, it's totally impossible. Like the right guys or the right-wing guys or conservative guys that are influential, they have like thousands of views, likes, and so on. So it's quite interesting. Like I never was expecting this, you know, like or to be so quick. I don't know if we have the enough time, you know, because we are like in a demographic nightmare. Portugal is one of the worst places in Europe, despite being a poor country. But yeah, I hope we have like time for this to change, to do a regime change to the right and apply the right policies. I really hope that I think the next, I would say, 2 years, because it's going to be elections, will be pivot will be very, very, very important, and from there we will see.
Well, that's very, very encouraging. I'm glad to hear that. A couple of years ago, it was back, I think it was, oh gosh, more than 2 years ago, it was back in 2022 now. I read a book by Tom Gallagher called Salazar, The Dictator Who Refused to Die. And I believe this author is, I think he's a Catholic writer. And I didn't know what to expect of this book, but I certainly didn't expect a pro-Salazar biography. Yet it is. It's a pro-Salazar biography. And he makes a strong case for Salazar being a very important figure in 20th century European politics. And a lot of people don't know about him outside of Portugal. So, can you say a little bit about Salazar and specifically the idea that people in Portugal today have about him, especially people on the right? Are there people who look back to Salazar and his dictatorship and think that it was a good time and a good model?
Yes, now is now because Chega is in second place. I think ideological speaking, people are more they choose their side of the barricade, and the left really tried to create like a demon of Salazar. But this was very, very different from 20, 10 years ago. So the reality it was that. When I was young, that people respect Salazar. You could, you know, you have to be really like a hardcore communist, you know, to talk really like trash talk about Salazar. It was like consensus, like respect to Salazar, because it was very, you know, especially on the right. You know that in the right, many times you have like these anti-fascist people on the right. It's a normal thing, but in Portugal it was always this very, very good respect because Salazar was in power for 40 years and he died poor, so he was very humble. He was very Catholic. He was very devoted. Yeah, the view for the society and he projected to it. It was very different from, for example, the fascism or the National Socialism. It was very galvanized. It was about revolution and change of society. Not Salazar. Salazar wants like a quiet society, rural society, you know, some elites to give some guidance. And even Salazar was very open about it. Like people have to work, think about family, you know. And let you know the elites do their jobs. So yeah, and also Salazar associated with you know how Portugal was were in trouble after the first republic when we overcome our monarchy that we had like for 800 years. Believe it or not, we are like one of the oldest countries, especially with the older borders. In the world, and yeah, Portugal was very chaotic. It was bankrupt. It was behind everyone in terms of education, literacy, technology, even industry. And Salazar changed that, you know. He built schools everywhere, universities. Of course, with time, was more limited, this. But, of course, it was a big boom with him in the 20s and the 30s. And he created industry and, like, idea of respect and pride of Portugal. And we went from bankrupt to grow a lot in terms of economy and going in a good direction. So if you looked at the charts, economically we were growing, going in a good way. So in this way, you cannot complain. It wasn't like, you know, like a Romanian or Soviet times where the economy was like sometimes not showing so well and people were starving, not with Salazar, you know, like in Franco, things were going well. He was creating industry, creating sovereignty and so on. So people respect this, you know, and above all, it wasn't corrupt. It was a very correct person. And of course, it was like some corrupt situations in the government, but not never directly with Salazar. And it was like they were very small comparing with, you know, after the revolution in 74. Or with other countries. So, you know, people really respect Salazar. They really appreciate the work he did. Of course, many people don't like him because they are from the left and so on. But even then, especially elder people, they have some respect. They can vote, for example, to the Socialist Party or something like that. But they will, like, remember Salazar is, you know, it was a good time. It was a good guy. They will have some nostalgia, some respect. But nowadays it's a bit different because things are very ideological and they sometimes deny the historical situation, the context, as you know, and they try to, you know, make Salazar is like cruel, vile dictator, but I think many times they failed to create his image. I think like common people don't agree with that, which is very different from, you know, Mussolini or Hitler or with, you know, E2, whatever.
What struck me about this book also struck me about the situation with Mussolini in Italy, which is that when Italy was reunified and they had the House of Savoy ruling and they had a liberal democracy, a parliamentary democracy, it was kind of chaotic. Nobody was really responsible. Nobody could take charge of things. And so the country just drifted for decades. And there was a long list of absolutely essential infrastructure projects, absolutely essential reforms, things that were, as we like to say, no-brainers. They just needed to get done. And yet, under 60 years of liberal democracy, they just weren't getting done. And what Mussolini did that made him very popular is he took responsibility for good or ill and got things done. And people just breathed a sigh of relief. And I thought that the Gallagher book sort of presented the situation in Portugal the same way, that liberal democracy really wasn't a very reliable way of ensuring the common good of the nation. And so this professor, this technocrat, this mandarin, this economist, he took over and got things done that the liberal democracy was incapable of doing. Now, the only things that I think people could really blame him for would be that they could present as violent or oppressive is he did try and keep the overseas empire of Portugal. But in terms of actually how he ruled the country, he seemed to be a very, you know, gentle ruler. Wasn't imprisoning or murdering people that he disagreed with. He was very modest. He seemed to be totally incorruptible. and he didn't seem to have an ounce of vanity about him. His kind of extraordinary figure. He just seemed to be the guy who took power out of a sense of duty to the country and held on to it for decades. It's kind of a remarkable story, because most people, when they think of authoritarian leaders, they think of charismatic, narcissistic, even, you know, larger than life, even maniacal types. And he just wasn't anything like that. He was just this kind of mild-mannered, incorruptible, modest guy who just ran his country for 40 years. It's an extraordinary story.
Yes, you use a word very, very well, duty. Definitely, it was duty, doing a duty for Portugal, and he viewed himself doing this. More than, you know, creating a legacy, an image. They tried to do like a little bit in the 30s and 20s to create this image of Salazar. But even was like, not like in other countries, you know, like it was very modest how they do it. And it wasn't his style, definitely. But yeah, this I think you put it very well. You did a very good resume of how Salazar ruled Portugal, you know, like also goes a little bit like our way to be, you know. Portuguese people are very, you know, they're quiet and they try not to, you know, like to be show off.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's very interesting because we're talking about before, it's not very related with this, you know, but you know, these attacks between, you know, right wingers, you know, like they have like a really big ego and so on. And Salazar was definitely like, you know, I wish that we had like people like this, you know, somehow. But I think this will be like more and more difficult with times, especially with technology and the sense of duty. Doesn't exist as much as before. Of course, we have like sometimes these phenomenons on like liberal democracies, you know, like some guys, you know, are quieter and they just want to, you know, follow the book. And but yeah, again, it's a liberal democracy and it keeps failing and it's not so sensible for the future. Just a like a small note for Salazar. Talking about the empire, yeah, I don't think he was violent in the empire. I think he shocked international community because he still had a huge empire. You know, Angola is fairly big, and other territories we had in Africa. And also in the Pacific. And, you know, even in this situation, it was like very moderate. You know, for example, in Angola, the capital of Angola back in the days, it was more developed than Lisbon, the capital, mm-hmm. You know, because there was so much resources there, so much rich health. They really, really developed the city.
Mm-hmm.
And even nowadays, you know, people from Angola, I think it's very unanimous how they, you know, especially the elder ones, they will say, yeah, back in the days were good times. They really developed the country. They create industry. Mm-hmm. And you could see it's like science on the technology and so on. And you know, they still have lack of this in their societies. Yeah, it was just the thing that we had like colonies or we were oppressing some native people or whatever. And this was like the thing that was shocking more people. And also this way, this created a war and a revolution and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And envy, of course.
Well, we should wrap up. We've been going for almost 2 hours. I really appreciate your time. There's a conference coming up at the end of the month in Porto. It's the Remigration Summit 2026. I wish I could go to that. I know a lot of friends are going to be there. Are you going to be there, and will you have your book on sale?
Yeah, actually, I forgot about the small details. So how I start to write this book. So I want to write this book because, like you said, you didn't write this book. Someone needed to write. And I was waiting and waiting and waiting to have something like this. And I took the initiative. I really like books and everything's involved with this. But so it was a big challenge. And I was writing this book. I was thinking, who's going to publish this book in Portugal? You know, the other two publishing houses that are more right-wing, they are pro-Russian. So they will never publish my book. Should I publish my book in Portuguese in Amazon? I think it was very limited, this. So I thought, I'm going to create my publishing house. I have so much contacts. Maybe I can publish books. So I co-founded the publishing house, Lumbrando, which is my book is published. And yeah, my publishing house is going to be is going to have a stand on re-immigration summits. So we're going to like sell my book and also our first book that was re-immigration, a proposal by Martin Selner. So we were like very lucky and very honored to publish Martin Selner's book in our publishing house before my book even. And yeah, so I'm going to be there. I'm excited. I was there already in Milano. Also was this year, I don't know if you know this event called Iliad in Paris. And I'm always very excited to, you know, to have this network, to meet people. I have always a very good spirit afterwards and during these events in a positive way. And you always feel like more energy to keep like your cultural battle and to keep like great contents and, you know, publishing books and so on. So I'm really like, you know, you get very revitalized, you know, like you get like this extra energy afterwards. So yeah, I'm really excited. This year is going to be in Portugal. Reconquista, from Afonso are organizing. They really did like a big event last year, Reconquista. They really shocked everyone because they got without a place, without a venue, like 24 hours before. And they, in 24 hours, they found like a place and it was outstanding. It looked like it was like the Marines there, you know, to prepare all the logistics, and it was only the activists. It was insane. They really did, like, it was super professional. They like, so I'm expecting really good things from these events. We'll see. Like Kate Woods did a really good review of this event of Reconquista, how professional it was, that it was also like English translation that you could put in your phone, in your ears. So yeah, I don't expect nothing, you know, less than that. So yeah, I think it will be a very good event. In my opinion, they could do it a little bit different, you know, like more like a summit vibe than a conference vibe. You know, it should be like debates, workshops, and so on. But maybe they're gonna have this. Who knows? Or in the future. But yeah, if I don't see you this year, definitely next year, Greg. I don't know where they're going to do it next year, but yeah, definitely you should go, and everyone that you know want to go should you know invest their time and money.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and folks, if you're serious about these issues, if you're interested in the Ukraine debate, if you want to have a book that you can give other people that'll get them up to speed, I highly recommend Luis's book, Ukraine, An Identitarian Perspective. I really like that it has both sort of objective chapters that just deal with particular issues, and then he has his personal reflections and experiences between the chapters. So there's sort of a nice variety there. And I found it to be, well, I wish I had written this book. And I'm glad somebody did write it, because it should have been written a long time ago. And I'm glad that he did such a good job. So folks, pick it up. And I really wish it could be in Porto. But if you have any chance of going to the Remigration Summit this year, it has a stellar cast of people speaking. And I'm sure there are going to be some fantastic people there just to hang out with and network with. So I really hope you can all go. Next week, I will be back with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. I'm going to be speaking with an American political candidate, a former J6er named Tyler Dyke, and I'm very much looking forward to that. So in the meantime, just keep reading Countercurrents. Thank you.
Thank you.